time. But so we're on to page 18. Pasuk Chaf. Verse 20. So here, this is the pasuk. I don't really understand what the Malbim says about this pasuk. He says, "Vayikra." The pasuk says, "Vayikra Adam Shem Yishto Chava," and the man called his wife's name Eve. Ki here I saw Ein Kol Chai, because she had become the mother of all the living. Right? I don't know what it means. She had become, but she, literally Hebrew just means she was. But in any event, the Malbim tries to explain why he only named her after the sin. Do you understand what he's bothered by?
He renamed her. Because she already gave her name.
You think Esau was a name?
Why not?
It could be. Okay, why rename her?
As well, why rename her? They had a kind of wife, woman.
Woman.
Woman. Yeah, it's just a name.
So, okay, no, it could be.
What's this color, wife, woman?
That's what the
truth does. I find it similar to I was doing with you.
But you're not asking the question.
No, I think that it might be similar to the event when Adam was naming each of the animals, that he saw the essence and which was the mission of the animals, and that's why he gave them to them. And in this place, when Adam is renaming the animal, then it seems that her mission and her essence changed. That's why he needs to give a different name.
Okay, true. So why this name now?
Because after they were punished, the mission was changed, or the word.
I'm saying, how did it change? How did it change?
How
is it reflected in the name?
Okay, I didn't know that.
That's what I was trying to figure out. What people says, Chava, it means the way he explains it is something to do with being the mother of all human beings. Like the language of Chayim, right? No, they were supposed to have kids. So it'd be a good call
of Muslim. Right, it is of course not legal because she was not the mother of all the animals. Right, it is definitely not legal.
I always understood it to mean all the living human beings, but maybe you're right, maybe it's not to be taken literally.
No,
I don't know if that's what I'm saying. You're right, of course the article sounds like it's focusing on the animals, but I never understood it that way. I understood always that she was the mother of all human beings who came after from her progeny. Now, tell you what the Malbim says. The Malbim says that the woman who was given to him in order to help him out. She's called, the Ezer Kenegdo, the helpmaid opposite him. And once he saw that she gave him counsel to do bad stuff, right, he decided it's not proper to call her Isha. Isha was to help the Ish. Isha's man. Isha is to help the Ish. She messed up. She never fulfilled her role as Isha. So therefore, all we can say about her is that she is suitable to give birth to kids. To help me out, she's not helping me out. But we shall be able to generate subsequent generations of human beings. So I think there's a Gemara which, I forget who it was, I think Rav, I'm not sure for sure, Rav says to his uncle Rabbi Chia, but a very shrewdish wife, I think that's the one. Because the wife tormented him. Like, in order to get him to do something, he had to tell the opposite. Because she was always doing the opposite of what he wanted. What? Yeah, so he wouldn't do that. So Rav said, why don't you tell the opposite? And he said, because I don't want to watch. So he made everything went wrong for him. So it was right, so I think that that's the truth. So anyway, his nephew said to him, so why don't you get divorced? So he said, no, it's enough that she saves me from sinning, I imagine, because, he doesn't look for other women, and that she raises my children. That's the bare minimum of what a wife is supposed to do. So therefore, what according to the Malbim, this is a similar thing here. Adam is saying is that, well, she can't be the ideal mate for me with all those beautiful and romantic connotations, but at least she can bear children for me. And I have to appreciate the fact that she can bear these children. That's what he said. And this is a really, a really tough statement to make. It's because I always thought there's a positive thing that he called his chava. So what he says is a negative thing. He viewed her as animals view their females, that they're always for the purpose of sustaining the species. So it's a very strange thing. The way Marvin learned it, again, because it's a negative. So the truth is that I think we could probably learn it as a positive as well if we try to flip that Malbim a little bit. I don't know what is whether it's correct to do so, but it would seem to me that perhaps before the sin, so they didn't have, you know, the relationship which was necessary, or even what's the word? Not necessary, in which they
ideal
relationship, in which he would actually give her a name and have a close relationship to her. There wasn't that type of world at that time, because it hadn't yet developed to the point. There's only a few hours of the existence of the world hadn't developed yet to the point where there was any true relationship between the man and the woman. The relationship only began later on when they actually had to live together as husband and wife. So then after they were banished from Gan Eden, not because they couldn't have done it earlier, but because the relationship only occurred later on, so then he gave her the name Chava in order to give her like an honorific title, not as a negative title, that look at what a noble woman she is. She is the mother of all those things which are going to come into being. But, you know, I don't know if that's true or not true. The Malvim again learns it as being a pejorative, a derogatory term. And the truth is that what seems to make the Malvim correct is that the difference between Adam and Chava. Adam has nothing to do with his procreating. It's saying he is man in and of himself, right? He's something significant in and of himself. Whereas Chava focuses on the fact that she can have children, meaning that she's really, for herself, inconsequential. But the fact is that she can have children, and therefore, because of that, he gives her respect, but not because of the fact that she actually is something significant in and of herself. That's clearly how the Malbim is learning it, okay? So maybe he's right. Now, the Malbim here goes at tremendous length into an interesting discussion about Adam, Chava, and the snake. And he says, it's almost a psychological interpretation, and he says that these three components which existed in creation as separate entities prior to the sin are now within each and every individual. Every person has its own personal Adam, Chava, and Nochash, right? Those are the three parts of the human personality. So what are the three parts of human personality? The Nochash, obviously, starting from the bottom up, the Nochash is the power which persuades an individual to do bad things, right? To go and follow his own heart's content, right? Then there is Chava, the part of the soul which is easily swayed by that type of enticement. And then there is Adam, which is the intellect of an individual. The person's, obviously, the main focus of a person's thoughts is his Adam, and the question is whether that Adam will be able to have more influence on the Chava than the Nachash, or whether the Chava will have more influence on the Adam, and therefore bring all the bad stuff which the Nachash persuades her to do into the realm of the Adam. So basically we have the Adam, the Chava, and the Nachash. Well, if we look at it, three parts of the body, you know, the head, the heart, and below the belt. Obviously, those could be the three regions, the head being Adam, the heart being Chava, and below the belt being the Nachash. One could also look at it as not necessarily being regions in the body, but rather being psychological states of mind which occur within an individual. But what's really fascinating is this Medrash actually, I mean, this Malbim explains the Gemara. He explains several Gemaras on the basis of this. He takes a couple of allegorical Gemaras, which appear in Baal Basra, and explains how they work out according to this. And he also explains the Eitz HaDaas Tov V'Ra. In other words, he has now, every person is confronted in life with these two paths, which are good and bad. The tree of good and bad means a person can go on the path of, you know, being able to live a proper lifestyle and do the right thing and be an honest and respectful person, or a person can go off to the bad side and, you know, do things which are improper and incorrect, right? And there's a tree, which means life, which provides very often enticements of things which are good and bad wrapped together. Meaning, there's lots of stuff in this world which is pure evil, and there's lots of stuff which is pure good, but most stuff in the world is a mixture of good and evil together. A lot of things which we confront are not completely bad or completely good, but the question is whether they're better or worse, whether it's more good or more bad. So really that's because of the confrontation with the Eitz HaDaat. Because the Eitz HaDaat Tova Ra, it has some good aspect to it, right? It had, the fruit was beautiful, and it was causing that. It seems to have a nice chava also on a spiritual level. But the question is whether man is going to actually follow that to that and go into a negative realm or not. And I'm going to expand upon that in a minute. But before I get there, let me talk about man going back into man himself and these three components. The Gemara says that when everybody dies, the first stop they make is by Adam HaRishon. And they go to Adam and they say, I'm paraphrasing, they say, you jerk. I have to die because of you. Had you not sinned, I would have been still alive. Right? So Adam says to Adam, says to him, oh yeah, you think so? Again, I'm paraphrasing. He says that, didn't you do X, Y, Z? So he says, I says, yeah, I did that. So he said, so you're full of baloney. Where you will cause your own death. So the question is, is Adam already instilled within an individual that external nachash, that external temptation is now part of a human being because of what Adam did? So what does he mean? It's still his fault. Because he is the one who caused me to sin, in that sin, since I only sin because of my negative inclination, which comes from him. So obviously the answer is, Rabbi Yeshua says this, the Mama doesn't say it here explicitly, but it's obvious, that every person has sins, which is Yetzer Hara causes him to commit. So certain sins which are Yetzer Hara causes you to commit because, you're a human being, and you have inheritance, that heritage from Adam HaRishon that you have in Yetzer Hara. But every human being also commits sins which their Yetzer Hara didn't necessarily compel them to do. Meaning people of their own volition go into areas and realms of sin which are not necessarily part and parcel of their original Yetzer Hara. Because the Yetzer Hara of every individual is different. And some people have a big Yetzer Hara, some people have a small Yetzer Hara, and anybody can either contract or expand the Yetzer Hara. It's not a static thing. It's constantly in flux and it's dynamic. So therefore, what Adam HaRishon says to him, for example, just taking a wild example, he says, listen, you did not have a Yetzer Hara to eat oysters. Right? I don't have a Yetzer Hara to eat oysters. I don't know what they taste like. I don't know if they're worthwhile. So I'm no Yetzer Hara to eat oysters, right? But I couldn't develop the Yetzer Hara to eat oysters, right? I have to go and eat my first oyster and see how wonderful it tastes. I assume it tastes good. Otherwise, why would I eat this stuff? I could go and take my first oyster and enjoy it. And then I'd be developing my own Yetzer Hara to have oysters.
You have to first.
What?
Why would you take that first oyster?
I'm saying it would be a decision I would make, right? But it's not because of the Yetzer Hara, it's because of curiosity. It's not because somebody enticed me to do it, because I don't have a desire. I walk past the McDonald's, I have no desire to, I read here for a minute, there's a story, it's not a great story, but it's interesting one. There's a story that Rabbi Weinberg from Baltimore, brother of Noah Weinberg, once gave a speech to Bali Tshuva, which he said that every single trait, there's some letters, every single thing which is trait has a corresponding kosher substance, which tastes as good and similar to the trait thing. Don't ask me if it's true or not. I don't know. So the woman came up to him after the speech and said, Rabbi, what can you please tell me what substance tastes like oysters? Because I've been dying to have oysters ever since I became through. And he did not have the answer, obviously. Obviously there's something special about it. Of course, a person like that, this woman, was born with the Yetzer Hara, let's assume, because of her environment, where God placed her when she was born, she had the Yetzer Hara to eat oysters to begin with, right? So therefore, she can come to other nations and say, it's your fault to have the Yetzer Hara to eat oysters. But I wasn't put in such an environment when I was born, and I never had a desire to eat an oyster, to have a cheeseburger, or anything of that sort. So therefore, if I would come to the point where I would start doing it, so then other nations would say, you see, were you in my position, you would have done the same thing. Because you're just like me. You didn't have the Yetzer Hara, but out of curiosity, out of inquisitiveness, out of a wrong calculation, you went and you did it yourself. So therefore, you're exactly as I am. And it seems that Ozma Rishon is able to say that to every single human being. I don't know, maybe not everybody. But most human beings is able to say that too. Yeah.
I have a problem with that, because if you're saying that curiosity, or you're saying, oh, everyone else didn't say so good, I don't know what the big deal is. Can you try not to? You're obviously not using your intellect if you're through, because if you know that God has forbidden you to do this thing, the only thing that would cause you to do that is if you're distracted by your intellect or by your emotion, your desire, and then you do something because your intellect sort of takes a back seat, and you know it's wrong, but you're going to do it anyway because you think it might be good. And so I would say that the curiosity is a Yitzhahara, the fact that you're doing it because you're saying, what's the big deal? I want to do it. Everyone says it tastes good, so I'm going to try it. Isn't that a Yitzhahara because you're putting your intellect in the back seat? Because your intellect will tell you, yeah, okay, fine, it's good, but I can't do it.
I'm not sure. I don't agree, because I think there's a difference between when your emotions persuade you to do something, so you do emotionally, which is usually associated with the Yetzer Hara, and a decision to, what's the word I'm looking for, to put your intellect in a box and say, I will ignore the facts for the time being, or the facts is that the axioms by which I normally live, and now go out and see what actually happens in the wide world because I'm curious about it. I mean, it's the same thing. I don't think it's the same thing as emotion talking you in a certain direction. It's you're not thinking necessarily the way you should, but nevertheless, it's not an emotional thing. I'm not making myself clear. Let me try and say it better. That there are certain things which a person perceives to be true, but which a person can willfully ignore. Meaning, I perceive that it is dangerous, let's say, I perceive that there's a table here, right? You perceive that there's a table here? So I can decide that I'm going to willfully ignore it and go start walking. Now, that would be kind of stupid of me, right? Because actually, I would bang into the table, right? But, let's say I know it's very, very dangerous to cross the throughway by foot, right? It's probably pretty likely that you'll get killed doing so, right? And I know that, but I decide, I want to cross the throughway by foot. Right? So see what it's like, But I don't know exactly. So in that case, what I'm doing is there's a certain thing which is true, but it's not a physical reality. And if I can choose to ignore it and like put it in a box and then go and do something which otherwise I wouldn't do. But not because my emotions are causing me to, I have a tremendous desire to cross the throughway. I might not have a desire to cross the throughway. I might just want, I want to get to the other side like a chicken. So therefore, it's not necessarily that I'm going to, it's not necessarily that I have a tremendous desire, but because of some circumstance, I relinquish those truths, I ignore those truths that I know to be true.
That's a willful sin, though, isn't it?
Because
you're intellectually deciding to go against the...
Right, but that's not the
answer after. It's a willful sin, it's a
You're saying it's worse, right?
Much worse.
But it's worse. So it's an intellectual decision to sin, right?
Right.
So if you make it, that's what Adam did. He made an intellectual decision to sin. He thought it was the right decision. You might well think it's also the right decision at the time you make it.
Well, if you think it's the right decision, then it's not what we think.
No, it is. Because
you want to do it.
Because in order to do that, you have to ignore something else that you know to be true or assume to be true. In other words, he had to ignore, at that moment when he was going to eat the food, he had to compartmentalize and say, God told me not to eat it, true, but let's ignore that for a moment, or let's rationalize that for a moment. So yeah, you're right, it's an intellectual sin, and that's precisely what Arnim Rishon did at that time, I think.
And one more thing, I've also heard that the number one tool of the Yitzhahara is rationalization, where the Yitzhahara will rationalize the sin in your head, like, oh, that's not so bad, or that's only a rabbanan, or that's only a custom. Or, it doesn't mean for everything.
Like,
it's very rationalizations, and that's what leads you to do.
Well, according to the Malbim, three levels, right? So what happens in that case is, first the Nachash gets a hold of you, right? And that's why Chazal say, "Ein adam chote elam ken nichnas bo ruach shtus." A person doesn't sin unless he has a spirit of insanity. Now, this is not the type of insanity with which you get off the hook if you go to court and you plead insanity. But what this means is that it's an irrational thing to sin. It comes from an emotional desire. So it's not really rational, it's something which is irrational. It's very rare that, this situation which you just depicted, where a person sins out of reason. So what happens usually is the person has this urge, and that urge persuades, you know, that urge persuades something emotional within him, and that emotional thing then goes to the mind and says to the mind, okay, let's find a rationalization which will allow us to do that. So the question is, does it start from your mind itself, or does it start from the tub of the Yetzer Hara, go to your emotions, and then go up to your brain afterwards? What? Okay, so
why don't you want to do it?
What?
Why would you rationalize to do something if you didn't want to do it?
Right.
I can rationalize that I'm allowed to, you know, use voices, but I don't want to use voices, so why would I rationalize to do it?
True. Usually you'll rationalize as a result.
Exercise, I mean.
I don't know, but you're right. Usually you'll rationalize as a result of trying to, you know, make your emotions fit in. Or rather, square away somehow the dissonance between your emotions and your intellect. Which is actually the big thing, which the rabbis tell us, that a person always has to be careful not to have vested interest when he makes decisions. Because every time a person has vested interest when he makes decisions, he can't be completely objective, then he'll start rationalizing. He'll really take his subjective perspective, even if it's not starting with the nachash, it doesn't start with the tov nor dibur. But even if it starts with the emotions themselves, you can't actually then be objective. You have to try and find some way, as much as possible, to separate yourself from your emotion and look at something objectively before you make a decision.
So don't go shopping when you're hungry.
Right, exactly. At least not in the supermarket.
Yeah.
Now, one other thing before we stop is that in the Kabbalistic perspective of things, then there are two types of klipos. The klipos are things which are bad, the husks. And without going into the whole Kabbalistic discussion of how the husks came into being, but they are bad stuff, right?
Husks.
Like a broken shell.
Okay.
Right. The what happened? I still have to get into this tomorrow, because it takes so too long. But let me just start. The way the Kabbalists understand the world was created, there was a lot of, first Hashem made vessels, and then he shined light into those vessels. It's just a metaphor. He shined light into those vessels, and the vessels broke. And with them, they took sparks of light all over the world, right?
Right.
And according to the Kabbalists, we have to go and we have to uplift those sparks, right? Halos and Itzotos is called. We have to uplift the sparks which are scattered all over the world. Mm-hmm. The thing is, what are the sparks in now? They're encased in these klipos, in these husks, the shards of the vessels which broke. Mm-hmm. So some klipos, the three lower klipos, are klipos which are completely off limits. You can't do anything with them. At least not in this world. There's too much evil associated with them. But there's the fourth klipa, which is the least offensive one. They told me I walked in. I forgot. Yeah. Okay.
Anyone
is inviting?
Please.
Just speaking, please.